So,
hey,
I think, you know, it's time to be topical. We need to keep our cutting edge tradition of being the first source to talk about brand new. Brand new stuff. So, Dune.
Dune Part 2. Which just barely came out.
Like what? Only 3 months ago?
3 months ago.
Yeah, like for us.
It's already on streaming.
Yeah, super cutting edge.
So we are right on top of it.
It's under a year. It's pretty good for us.
We're getting to Dune like two or three times faster than we got to Across the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, yeah. And so, when I watched Ted Lasso,
oh,
like,
yeah,
5 years after the first season or something like that. So it wasn't 5 years, but yeah. So yeah, Dune.
Okay.
We're going to talk about Dune today. So
I saw Dune.
If you don't want to be spoiled for Dune 2, then you don't want to watch or listen to this episode. But we kindly gave you a buffer zone. It isn't that we had to wait 3 months.
We're not slow on, like, by accident.
Yeah.
We're slow on purpose. Because we are giving you this big, long time in which you can see Dune.
So remind me, what did you give Dune 1?
I loved Dune 1.
Was it a 10 out of 10?
Yeah, it's a 10 out of 10 for me. I thought it was fantastic.
It was a 10 out of 10 for me as well.
Yeah.
Shall we lead with our numbers on Dune 2?
On Dune 2?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Dune 2 is a 9 for me.
I was going to say 9.
Yeah.
I'm between 8 and 9.
Okay.
I don't know if I'll go as low as 8 because I really loved it. I loved everything about it. But somehow it didn't feel as urgent. It was a little slower. I don't know. It had at least one big narrative thing that did not work for me.
I will give it a 9 with the asterisk saying this might be the best way you could do Dune second half. Unless you split it into 3 movies, because Dune could very easily be split into 3 movies.
Mm-hmm.
So for those who don't know, the book has an odd structure in that basically where part one of the movie splits, you go away and you come back and it's years later, I think. It's like 2 years later.
It's 4.
It's 4. Okay.
Alia is 4 or 5. So yeah.
Is she 4? I thought she was like 3.
She's
got to be young enough that talking is weird, right?
Maybe she's only 3. I thought she was 4. Either way.
Either way, you come back, and what's that?
She's 2 years old.
She's 2 years old. Okay, then.
Aha.
I'm super wrong.
Well, it's between us, because she's 2 years old. It's been 3 years-ish. 2.5, and things like that. Yeah, she's got to be young enough that her talking is weird. If she were 4, talking is not bizarre.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? And so, basically, you come back, and you have skipped a lot of the fun part. You have skipped Paul and Chani falling in love, really.
Yeah.
Like the relationship, you've skipped everything in there.
Mm.
And you have skipped Paul becoming Fremen.
Yeah.
And you come back and Paul is Fremen. You know, there's still some things to prove, but he's
been fully accepted into their society. He's learned how to live in the desert.
He can ride a sandworm.
All this stuff.
Right? And all of these things. And that is necessary to keep the book from being 400,000 words long, but I would have probably written the book at 400,000 words. I appreciate that he didn't. That is the art he wanted to tell, but he skipped the fun part. He skipped the part that I love about books.
Yeah.
And Dune is still my favorite science fiction novel, him having done that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you approach this and you have to decide, am I going to do the time jump or am I not going to? And Denis decided not to do the time jump. He decided to revise the film so that you see, kind of not in montage, but half montage, the experiences from those 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he decides to make it only like 4 months instead.
He shortens the time. The actual time jump, I think, would come about an hour into this movie, which makes it even more awkward.
I mean, if he was going to do one, he has to do it at the cut. He can't.
Yeah, you would have to do it at the cut. Mm-hmm. But then there's all this early stuff, which would have changed the first movie so much as to make it very unwieldy.
Yeah.
And so, like you said, maybe it would have to be 3 movies instead of 2.
I think the story he wanted to tell should have been 3 movies. I think we should have come, and it's the next day, and you spend an entire film that culminates in Paul, like, riding a sandworm himself and things like that, and gaining, like, becoming Fremen to, you know, And then you do the last one as kind of the Count of Monte Cristo revenge comeback sort of thing. The Lion King returns sort of thing. So
splitting it where he did, doing it as two, I do think he cut it in the right place.
Yes.
And number two picks up like literally one frame after the first one ends. They're still going through the desert, carrying Jamis's body. And the way that he cut it there, not only did the first movie work really well, but it lets the second movie be entirely about Fremen culture, which we didn't really get into much in the first one. And so the two movies have very distinct flavors because of that, and it ends up working really well.
If you are not going to make three movies, which I bet he just couldn't, right? If you're not, then that's why the nine gets an asterisk. I think this is the best version he could have done under the narrative constraints that he was under.
Well, and I think it's worth pointing out that it probably never occurred to him to make it three. Maybe he hasn't, and you've read something I haven't.
No.
But this thought of showing the all the stuff the book skips over, I bet never entered his head. That's something you would have done, and maybe not something that he would
have. But he does show it. He shows some of it, at least.
Some of it in montage,
So, yeah. That's kind of my first takeaway as structurally, this is a very interesting problem to crack. And I appreciate the decision he made, and it, but it does kind of inform it. You said there's one thing that really doesn't land for you.
Yeah, Paul's heel turn in Act Three. I know where he's coming from, but it didn't felt like it was properly built up or explained.
I like it a lot.
It's a good way of telling the story.
Yeah.
Because really what we all like to ignore about the books is that Paul is a villain by book two.
But he doesn't think he is in the books.
He doesn't think
and
he
in
is.
In the movie, he does.
But he absolutely is. And I appreciate and I enjoy the way that they drew that out and drew a big line under it and said, look, he's embraced the Holy War, you know, his Harkonnen heritage, all this stuff. But part of this is kind of colored by the fact I saw the movie with my dad, who, well, and I have to tell you this, I didn't want to go see it by myself.
Yeah.
So I took my dad and we get in there and we sit down and he said, well, I've seen the first movie, but I don't remember it super well. And I'm like, well, you know, it's pretty good and it's kind of weird. And he's like, well, yeah, it's kind of weird, but a lot of things were pretty weird in the 80s. And I said, wait a minute. When you say the first movie, do you mean like the one from the 80s, the Ridley Scott one or whoever? And he's like, yeah, I actually haven't seen, it's not Ridley Scott. Who is it?
It's the Twin Peaks guy.
Oh, yeah. Kyle MacLachlan?
No.
No? Who is it then? I don't even remember.
Hey, Eraserhead.
David Lynch.
David Lynch. Yeah.
David Lynch. Mm-hmm. But isn't Kyle MacLachlan in it?
Let's find out.
Isn't he Paul?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So anyway, my father had seen that one. In the 80s, he read the book in the 80s, and he has not seen anything since.
Okay.
So, first of all, he was super lost by a lot of stuff.
Uh-huh.
Both part one and part two, the movies really don't hold your hand.
No.
If you don't already know the story, it's very easy to get lost in it. And he was completely lost, and Paul going heel turn at the end and becoming a villain threw him completely.
Interesting.
Which I can't help but feel that the movie itself was not laying the building blocks it needed to say, okay, this is why Paul is a villain.
I'm going to disagree. I think it's there. Now, I can't discount your experience and the experience, but they made a very big deal of putting him against Chani in this. And Chani says, if you do this, you become a villain, and then he did it. I don't think you can signpost better than that. If you take the step, you're a villain, and then he takes the step. Like, it's basically said.
Oh, it absolutely is. It's right on screen, but why did he take that step?
He took the step because he is a pawn of the Bene Gesserit as much as anything else. And now that, like, these forces of motion, he can't resist. If he goes south instead of going north, then the Harkonnens win. His father never gets revenged. The Fremen don't get, you know, he's got these things. And he's being told, you're a god, you're a god, you're a god, you're a god. And you see him wanting to just run off and just be a Fremen, but he's got his father's responsibility, right? Like that's the theme of the first movie is Paul has his father's training and responsibility. And he puts the ring back on that says, I am living the life my father wants. And what my father wanted was the Fremen to be our army.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it is there. I think it's all signposted. His father said desert power. At the end of the first movie, he looks and sees the Fremen and sees that this is the power to overthrow the Empire. And
And I agree that it's there. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that it is presented as well as I wanted it to be. It is a little sloppy. Even something like he has the perfect moment to say desert power in one of his conversations with him. And I was like, why did he not say desert power? I feel like the signposts were there, but they were very small and they were obscured in some cases. I don't know. I just wish there'd been more.
We'll just disagree on this because I think the whole second movie's whole point is signposting. Paul's going to be a villain. Paul's going to be a villain. Paul's going to be a villain.
He spends so much time fighting against it. He gets mad at his mom, much more angry with her than I remember him in the books.
Yeah.
And then I don't feel like I saw, I guess this is what it comes down to. I don't feel like I saw the moment he made the decision.
Right.
We get the moment where he's like, now I understand we are, you know, I'm a Harkonnen and, or Harkonnen, they say Harkonnen in the movies. That's not how I ever pronounced it. So I'm going to say Harkonnen forever.
I wonder, like, is this a thing where they went to Brian Herbert and they're like, how'd your dad say it? And he says, oh, he said Harkonnen, just like, you know, Smaug. And they're just, you know.
Shannara.
Yeah. See, Terry changed. He started saying Shannara after, you know, he's like, well, you know what? That tide has gone out. The ship has sailed. It's Shannara. I keep wanting to say it his way because but I had to make that distinct change. Anyway. Yeah.
So anyway.
I understand this complaint. Yeah. I disagree with it, but I understand this complaint.
I will say, though, in favor of these changes, pitting him against Chani worked really well. I love that. And that is a change from the books.
It is.
Chani never opposes him. And particularly in book two, Chani really fades into the background and just becomes an appendage of Paul.
Yep.
And so building this up so that they can be butting heads in the inevitable third movie, which has already gone into pre-production. We know it's happening. I think is a really smart, really good change.
Should they call the third one Dune Part 3?
Instead of Dune,
Dune Messiah. It's currently been talked about as Dune Messiah. I don't know if they're calling it Part 3.
Because I feel like you can take big chunks of Dune Messiah and just be like Dune Part 3, and then you've got a trilogy. That's what I would do.
You can easily merge Messiah and Children of Dune into one movie.
Yeah.
Very easily.
I think they just go with Dune Part 3.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
Yeah.
And then you've got a trilogy. It's really solid. You don't have to do any of the rest. Someone will try. But you can have Denny do 1, 2, 3. And you need Messiah, like, to really tell the full story. Mm-hmm. So I'm super glad you're getting it. When I read Messiah, I'm like, oh, this is just, I remember distinctly, and I can't remember, you know, now when it was. But I said, oh, this right here is where the end of Dune, the book, is. And it's the middle somewhere of Messiah. And so that's a really good change. What'd you think of Fade?
I loved him. I thought he was great. Though, here's my caveat to that.
Okay.
My two very favorite scenes in the book.
Uh-huh.
I complained about this last time. My first very favorite scene was completely cut out of Dune Part 1, which is the dinner scene when they arrive on Dune. Mm-hmm. And it's this incredibly layered and strategic dinner party with the Dune locals. And I can understand why they made that change because there's no way to film that properly. Yeah. My other favorite scene from the book is the knife fight in the gladiator arena on Gedi Prime.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, and they changed it. Mm-hmm. They showed it, but they changed it. And in the book, there is apparently a Harkonnen tradition. The reason he had a white knife and a black knife is because one of them is poisoned. And what Fade has done is changed which knife has poison on it. And so the guy he's fighting can allow himself to take a couple of hits from the non-poisoned knife in order to try to win. But then he dies because Fade put poison on the wrong knife. And then the scene ends with him looking at the cheering crowd and holding up the knives and saying, let them know that they will never know which hand holds the poison, which is such a killer line and says so much about Fade. And that was taken out of it. And so, again, I can understand why they did that. Because as soon as they said poison knife in that scene, then they would have to explain why there's not poison on the knife in the final fight. Like, there's a lot of good narrative reasons to have done it. But it made me sad because my two favorite scenes from the book are not really in the movie.
I will agree with you. I thought Fade worked well. I mean, let's be honest. The Fade stuff in the book is all awesome, but Paul versus Fade is never in the book ever been as, like, it never quite lands that this is the Harkonnen heirs fighting each other for which version of the Harkonnen, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah, these are the two messiahs. Which one's going to win?
Yeah. It's not built up enough to make that justifiably the final confrontation. Paul has already won everything when that fight happens, and it always feels like a bit of an afterthought.
Yeah.
Because there's not a personal stake between Paul personally and Fade personally. There's a stake between their fathers. And so this landed really well with that constraint of let's do what is in the book, like thematically in the book. And so I did like that. They did the work they needed to at least get across what Frank Herbert's feelings on that were. I still wish there were a fight at the end which were more personal to Paul, right? But it would have to be like, I don't know how you get that in the book, right? It has to be someone he's faced and failed to defeat before.
Yeah, and then comes back.
And then comes back with...
Or a style of fight that he's lost before. We've never seen him lose a knife fight.
Yeah, he's won every knife fight.
Yeah.
He's trained by the two best warriors in the galaxy. And
yeah. I wish there were more of a tri-fail cycle there where we get to see him not just winning that fight, but overcoming something intrinsic to him in order to win the fight. And we don't get that, but like you say, it would be virtually impossible something like that in there.
So, and Dune is a story of the forces crashing together more than it's a story of individuals.
Yeah.
And Paul becomes one of those forces. And so it works. So
well, and I do like the way that they really kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? They showed the Bene Gesserit, particularly through the Reverend Mother. They're the ones pulling all the strings. They're the ones in charge. And, you know, in that final fight where right before the fight, she says something to him and he says, be quiet, and uses the voice and completely overpowers her. That is exactly what we were just bemoaning the knife fight didn't have, because we have seen her overpower him with the voice.
Yep.
And he is now no longer being controlled by the Bene Gesserit. He's not following their game plan. He's overcoming them. And so that aspect of it worked really well.
I've seen complaints online about casting Christopher Walken as the Emperor. And I will just have to say I disagree with those. When he came on as the Emperor, I'm like, that is perfect casting. That is who he is in my head. Mm. And people have trouble seeing beyond Christopher Walken to the Emperor. Yeah. Did you have that problem?
I don't know. I kept waiting for him to do something important or dramatic. And I can't decide whether this is a thing that I love or a thing that I am okay with. Really, they present the Emperor as completely banal.
Completely weak.
Yeah.
I like that.
He's not in charge. The Bene Gesserit are clearly the ones doing everything. Even in his own home, it's Reverend Mother and Irulia that are doing everything. And so I am not certain what they gained by casting Christopher Walken. Because what they lost was a lot of people going, oh, wow, Christopher Walken. Like, he's so recognizable and so unique and strange in so many ways that it was hard to see him as the Emperor. It was mostly just I saw him as Christopher Walken.
So, you know? I can see, like, a lot of people online are saying that. For me, Christopher Walken brings a world weariness to everything he does. And this interpretation of Dune, this interpretation of Emperor, is the entire, like, seat, the entire line, the entire, is exhausted.
Yeah.
Like, this is a decaying empire on the brink of collapse, who has made a fatal error in killing the only, after
the
Paul
only
falls,
just a
noble the only just
Duke.
A noble, noble person that we have met anywhere, right? Like, you know, I like the Fremen, but they're not just a noble. They might be just, right?
Yeah.
But their justice is, well, we have no empathy for any, you know, we're leave you to the desert. And that's the life they have to live. You can't really blame them for it because things are so harsh. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like there is nobody and he killed him. And that is a representation of the fear, the empire, the emperor as an entity, not as a person, has of someone who is who he should have been. And this is what Paul needs to cast down. And it's horrifying the way he's going about it, and we should be horrified.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie makes it clear that, yes, you should be horrified.
Yeah.
But in the other side, if the emperor were strong and these sorts of things, I think that there would be no need. Like, there's not a gangrene that needs to be cut out.
Yeah.
So representing this works for me.
That's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder.
Yeah.
And it's pointless to wonder, but I wonder if they could have pulled that off with some other random unrecognizable old man, right?
Yeah.
If he was just a doddering fool instead of Christopher Walken, would that have worked better? I don't know.
I loved it. He came on screen like, oh, of course. His eyes say, I'm tired of everything. And so...
Yeah, anyway. He worked, ultimately. Mm-hmm. I don't complain about his casting. Mm-hmm. I just wonder about his casting a little bit.
Yeah.
So what do you think about Baron Harkonnen's death and end? Given that they did not do the time jump and we don't get toddler Alia.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to say...
It's really the only way they could have done it.
Not having toddler Alia is a huge boon. Because in every adaptation I've seen... The creepy baby has been so distracting that it's hard to take seriously. It works fantastically well in the book. Mm-hmm. You can imagine how creepy that is. But in all the adaptations, the one on Sci-Fi Channel and things like this, like she comes across as Chucky.
Yeah.
Right? Esque. Mm-hmm. And it is funny to me.
There's this element of grotesque to her that isn't really present in the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I do love the way they handled the pregnancy.
Yes.
Jessica in constant conversation with the
like
child.
That worked so well.
It was so good. Mm-hmm. Every aspect of it was good. Her showing up in Paul's dream as Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah.
Like, you know she was cast just because she has recognizable eyes. Because that's the only part of her visible. Yep. And everyone in the theater goes, wait, that's Anya Taylor-Joy. Who I didn't know she was going to be in the movie at all. I hadn't heard that. And so I thought that that worked well.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that she will still not be her in the third movie, that they'll get somebody else.
Hmm.
Because how old is Alia in Dune Messiah? Because I know Paul and Chani have kids.
I think they have kids after the time jump.
Yes, Alia is 16.
Yeah,
Alia is
16. After they have kids after...
Yeah. The Duncan Idaho part.
What?
With Alia.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. Wait, but we shouldn't. That's spoiler. Well, this is all spoilers. Spoilers for Dune
Messiah.
Spoilers
for these 60-year-old books.
Yeah. Spoilers. You're going to see.
I think
some...
putting a 16-year-old Alia into movie 3, if that's what they do.
Yeah.
Obviously, it still won't be on Taylor Joy, but.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
If we're asking about casting, the other big one I've seen online is Zendaya. As Chani. How do you guys feel about that?
She did a great job.
Yeah, she lands for me.
One thing about Zendaya, because I am old,
I
continually discount her because she is popular among teenagers, and there's some inner prejudice in me that is like, if someone's popular with teenagers, they must be ridiculous, which is a stupid attitude to have. Mm-hmm. And I don't have it consciously. I just assume that that's what's going on. And then every time I see Zendaya on screen, like in No Way Home and other things, she's incredible. She's a fantastic actor.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she did a wonderful job in this. She sold Chani. She was able to fall in love with Paul without becoming subservient to Paul, even narratively. I thought she was great. I think people who complain about her are, I don't know, dumb.
So minor quibbles, not about her. I thought she did a fantastic job.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody in this that I thought did a poor job with their, like, the casting was really great.
Casting
all
was
around.
Great. I wish And maybe this mm-hmm. is that hypothetical mm-hmm. Dune Part 1.5 that yes. you and I kind of both wish existed. Dave Bautista as Beast Raban
yeah.
still didn't really get to do anything, which is fair because he doesn't really get to do anything in the books either.
Yeah, he's sent to fail.
Yeah,
right?
Like I was excited yeah. to see him at least earn his nickname as the Beast. Let's see him be cruel and effective. Mm-hmm. And really, he never got to. And I was kind of hoping that would happen in Part 2 because we didn't get to see much of him in Part 1. But oh well.
Yeah.
Fade Rotha kicked it, was so great. And
the worst part of the movie, though.
Okay.
For me. In the crowd scene, I needed a Sting cameo.
Which crowd scene?
Crowd scene of the stadium.
Okay.
I needed just a shot of the crowd, and there's Sting next to Patrick Stewart, just hidden in the crowd.
Just in the background
just
somewhere.
Just in the background. I needed a Sting cameo somewhere in these movies. Didn't get a Sting. On a serious note, I would have liked a little more use of Mentats as a book fan.
Yeah, the Mentats disappeared completely.
I would have loved some glimpse of what the Navigators look like in his version because I bet they are super awesome. And I can't get out of my head the David Lynch Navigators.
Funky
and
fish tank.
I really want those out of my head because the green screen effect of them shooting through space is so goofy.
Yeah.
And I would have liked some hint of what a Navigator looks like now so I could expunge that. Those are super minor things. But the next movie, it's not too late to give Sting a cameo, Denny. Just saying.
You can do it.
It's possible.
When Josh Brolin shows up, when Gurney comes
yeah.
back,
mm-hmm.
I had to step out to go use the restroom at one part. And I made sure to wait for, like, I knew nothing interesting was going to happen. And so what I missed was the little tiny conversation where they're like, hey, let's go find the family atomics. Mm-hmm. And so I came back into the theater right as somebody said, all right, let's do it. And mm-hmm. I sat down next to my dad and I said, what are they going to do? And he said, Beard guy said that they need to go to this other place. And I'm like, you don't know who Gurney Halleck is. Which, again, because he didn't see Part 1, yep. and because this movie does not hold your hand at any point, mm-hmm. you're just supposed to recognize, oh, Josh Brolin was in the first movie. I know who this is. Mm-hmm. My dad was completely lost. This is not me critiquing anything. This is me laughing because my dad got confused by it. But anyway, it was fun.
How much do you think Dune 2 made?
How much do I think it made? I was watching the box office, so I kind of have an instinct. It crossed 500 million. I don't think it got to 6 or 7, but I know it crossed 5.
It did hit over 600 million.
It crossed 6. Okay.
Okay.
So it's not going to hit
Very
7,
good.
Most likely. But I believe the...
Never mind.
Oh, it did.
It has passed 700 million.
Seven. Passed okay, 700. There we go. But I believe it was profitable at like 4 something, right?
Yeah.
And so getting to 7 is fantastic. Plus, yeah. you know, streaming stuff, like, they've got to be very pleased with that. So what do we got there? Just
budget was 190.
Yeah, 190. So,
yeah,
so,
profitable at 4.
It's profitable at 4. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
That's great. That means that they made bank on this, right? Which mm-hmm. is good and bad. It means we're going to get a good Dune Part 3. It's bad because if I were Denny, I would leave then. And that means someone less talented
is going to make the much harder books.
The much harder books.
Ooh.
And that's...
Maybe.
Yeah.
There's a TV series that's uh-huh. in production called yeah. Dune Prophecy.
Okay.
Kevin's a producer on it. The guy who wrote the screenplays for the movies is uh-huh. either lead writer or showrunner. And so they might content themselves with a Dune TV show, which I think still has a huge uphill road to be as good as we want it to be,
yeah.
but is potentially less catastrophic than a bad movie would be.
Yeah, I agree.
Do they go the prequel route? Do they try and make that House Atreides movie?
I think so. If you're calling it Dune Prophecy and you're getting Kevin to mm-hmm. be producer on it, we're talking about Kevin J. Anderson, who has yeah. co-written all of the Dune prequels with mm-hmm. Brian Herbert, and who is one of my very good friends and wonderful. I think by necessity, that is implying that this will be prequel in some way. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're like which part of it they're going to do. I bet they go deep into the past. Robot rebellion, whatever that was called, Butlerian jihad, back to the beginning of the Bene Gesserit prophecy itself is what I'm going to assume that title is implying. So we're not going to be seeing the houses. I don't know if Atreides and Harkonnen and whatever were even around back then, but we are going to see the Bene Gesserit putting this plan into motion of creating the Kwisatz Haderach.
Tell me this.
Down the line.
When in history, can you think of a time in history where Hollywood has shown restraint regarding something that has made $700 million? Can you think of a time?
Restraint?
Yes. Where there has not been a sequel or remake of something that's made $700 million unnecessarily or even necessarily. Is there something that has been that successful that has not?
The best I can come up with is Avatar Way of Water, which still got made, but 15 years later. Like, they took their time.
He owns the IP.
To do it right.
And has Final Cut.
That's true.
But so that's not also, Hollywood. Hollywood doesn't have a choice.
He's absolutely part of Hollywood.
What I say...
when somebody makes more than $1 billion with most of their movies, they're not an indie director, even though still in charge of things. They're still part of the studio system.
So, when I say Hollywood... I'm saying the people who don't know how to make things.
You're talking about the money people.
But can call the shots.
Okay.
Right? When has a money person who can greenlight one of these things said no?
Yeah, you're right.
I can't
think of any.
And I don't think Denis has like Final Cut. I don't think he has like creative control. Maybe of his film he does. But anyway.
Certainly not of the property.
Right? Like, you know.
You're right. We might end up, some fool is going to try to make Children of Dune or Book 5.
Now, maybe the best
God
case...
God Emperor of Dune.
Well, yeah, God Emperor. God Emperor. That you could make a really good movie out of that, but you just need something super talented.
Someone super talented with someone that is okay moving away from the source material at right spots.
I disagree. I don't think it is even possible to make a good movie, a good adaptation of God Emperor.
Okay.
It's so fundamentally weird. Whereas, yes, if somebody says, let's go back and make some of these Brian and Kevin books, like the Atreides trilogy, like the Butlerian Jihad trilogy, I can absolutely see those working in a way that the original Frank Herbert stuff would not.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. How's that, Ben? A Jesuit.